The Guardian.
I'm Heather Stewart. This is Politics Weekly. As public sector pay becomes the latest political battleground, cabinet splits widen as Downing Street struggles to keep control. Are key Tories softening their stance on austerity? Or is it just the early pangs of the race to succeed Theresa May? Meanwhile, Labour reshuffles its junior ministers as the party chairman warns that it risks becoming too broad a church. What could he mean? Plus, we hear from Labour's leader in the Lords as she prepares to head the opposition's scrutiny of Brexit laws in the upper chamber.
Our role is going to be significant in the weeks and months to come.
And as data science becomes ever more powerful, are governments equipped to understand it, let alone regulate it? We hear from author and mathematician Cathy O'Neill.
Any decision-making process that affects a given person's life fundamentally should be questioned.
Joining me for all of this, Sam Hall of the conservative think tank Bright Blue and The Guardian columnists Polly Toynbee and Raphael Baer. Now, the government's own figures showed this week that teachers have seen their pay fall £3 an hour in real terms and police officers by £2 an hour between 2005 and 2015. It highlights the squeeze on public sector pay packets that have been fixed by a rigid 1% government cap. Well, Downing Street says it remains committed to the cap for now, but cabinet ministers have been peeling off one by one in recent days, Boris Johnson among the most high-profile doubters. Sam, when you can find £1 billion for the DUP at a week's notice, it's quite hard to say there's no money for nurses, teachers and police officers, isn't it?
I think it is. It is a very difficult argument at the moment for the Conservatives to maintain. And the story is at the moment that there's over about 40 Conservative MPs who would have been willing to have supported the Labour amendment, but obviously knew that by doing so they was in jeopardy.
This is Labour's amendment to the Queen's speech on public sector pay.
On public sector pay, exactly, yes. So I think there is a growing appetite in the Conservative Party to look again at the issue of public sector pay. But I at the same time, I also think that the fundamental narrative of the Conservatives over the past 7 years that we need to continue reducing the deficit still remains true, that the spending now on public expenditure, for current expenditure, will mean that borrowing more and future generations having to pay more in tax to fund that. And equally, as we approach Brexit and potential economic uncertainty because of that, the government needs to make sure that it's in a fit fiscal position in order to handle any potential economic downturn. So I think that the overall narrative of austerity does need to remain. And I think that if the Conservatives do choose to make decisions around public sector pay and loosening the cap, they need to find money from elsewhere, for example, by not doing some of the tax cuts or income tax or inheritance tax, for example. I think as well that the government signalled it's going to look at the public sector independent pay review bodies and listen to their recommendations. And I think that in situations like in nurses' pay, clearly there's a big recruitment crisis happening there. And I think there's a pragmatic case that in order to keep those public services staffed at the appropriate levels, that they will need to look again at loosening the pay cap for that sector. I think, yeah, it will definitely be looked at over the next year. And I think there's growing support within the Conservative Party to do so.
Polly, that feels right, doesn't it? I mean, why did it take the general election campaign for the Conservatives to realise that there's public concern about this issue? They must have been seeing people in their surgeries, mustn't they? They must have been hearing this from backbench MPs. Why has this suddenly become the issue of the moment?
Well, they thought they could hold the line. They thought Theresa May was going to get a great landslide. What happened during the election campaign, you should remember, was very precise. When Labour published its manifesto, things went with a bang. I mean, in May, in the middle of the election campaign, Labour were 11 points behind in the local election. It looked like total disaster. Everything seemed to turn around from the point at which the cornucopia of promises in Labour's election manifesto seemed to be what turned the tide, not just with the young, but lots of other people. Keeping the triple lock, which Theresa May said she'd cut, and a general sense of, you know what, we've had enough of austerity, we don't need it anymore. There are other ways of doing things. Sam has mentioned some of them, like not making extravagant tax cuts that really are heading in the wrong direction. But I also think during the election campaign, lots of Tory MPs and candidates stood outside schools and listened to parents at school closing time and heard the parents who just had letters from head teachers saying, over this summer, we are sacking teachers and we're losing nearly all of our teaching assistants. And that came as a great shock to the parents. And I think all these pigeons have come home to roost.
Raph, it was extraordinary at Prime Minister's questions today, I thought, that really this is Jeremy Corbyn's absolutely setting the agenda now, isn't it? I mean, isn't he? I mean, you know, his argument all along has been we mustn't let the debate be framed by the sort of Tories' narrative about austerity and this is all necessary and the economy's in a terrible mess. You know, we just have to, you know, make our own arguments and talk about people's lives and the pressures they're under and so on. This is absolutely, it feels as if the narrative has kind of moved, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, there's been a very dramatic shift since the election, and it's not just on this public sector pay issue. There seems to be lots of debate now around university tuition fees, which is a Labour manifesto point. And this is happening very early in a new parliament for the opposition to be essentially pushing the government into arguments that are defined on the opposition's terms. And obviously a lot of that is because Labour did surprisingly well for many people in the general election. It feels also, I think, to an extent, as if we're just feeling a bit of good old-fashioned pendulum swing here, actually. I mean, remember, you know, the Conservatives have been in government now for 7 years. Now, a lot of Tories, a lot of quite, particularly on the right wing of the Conservative Party, because the first five of those were in coalition with the Lib Dems, they don't see that as kind of proper, authentic Tory government. And then you had Brexit, which a lot of them thought of as, you know, the referendum as sort of starting year one, day one of a new revolutionary calendar, and sort of didn't count the Cameron era. But for everyone else, you know, we are aware of having been under a Conservative government now for quite a long time, and austerity being the background to that. So, I mean, as Polly said, it sort of feels inevitable in the way that you get this tremendous fatigue because there hasn't really been a dividend, an obvious moment of being able to say you put in all that pain. Yes, we all tightened our belts. Now you can argue about the distributional fairness of that, but essentially lots of people tightened lots of belts. And yet, you know, where's the reward? And as Polly said, then Labour came along with its manifesto and said, well, we've got a reward for you. It's just called, let's just not do this thing. I do think there's a separate point which Sam touched on, which is very important as well, which is that what you're seeing, what you saw in the election was the kind of collapse of the sort of narrative Theresa May wanted her prime ministership, her premiership to be about. She'd moved away from everything that George Osborne and David Cameron had said the Conservatives were going to be about, both as a kind of liberal modernising agenda in the early Cameron years, and then very much, you know, the fiscal discipline and austerity is a necessary, not very comfortable, but ultimately sort of virtuous thing that we have to do. Now, she jettisons both of those concepts and replaced them with a just let me do Brexit, because that's the sort of thing I have to do. And then when that was rebutted by the electorate in June, she found that there simply isn't actually a coherent story of what Conservative government is for at all now. And obviously in that vacuum, that gives the Labour a great opportunity to set the terms.
Well, and the fact that she was standing up in Parliament today and saying, well, we have to deal with the deficit or we become Greece, which, you know, was
George Osborne
was saying in 2010.
You know, yeah,
absolutely, which was not a sign of a government that had a lot of fresh ideas. Sam, we've seen one cabinet minister after another breaking to talk about public sector pay, amongst other things, you know, and Brexit and you know, various other things. What's going on there? Cabinet collective responsibility seems to have rather broken down, doesn't it?
I think it has. I think with the election result not going Theresa May's way and her losing her majority, I think it's cost her a lot of authority within the parliamentary party. And I think that it's only, I think, you know, obviously a lot of MPs are saying that it's unlikely she'll fight another election, which means that at some point there'll be a Conservative leadership election. And so cabinet ministers are, I think, with an eye to making a pitch for that eventual leadership election, breaking ground on certain areas of government policy, particularly public sector pay. I also suspect that they sense that a U-turn is in the air on this issue, and that with the government's very small or tight parliamentary arithmetic, that with that number of Conservative MPs now looking to see concessions from the government on this issue, they know that the government will change its position, and so they don't really feel tied to defend the line.
You might as well get ahead of it, I suppose.
Yeah. Exactly, yes.
But Polly, how stable do you think Theresa May's position is? It certainly feels unstable with cabinet ministers coming out and saying this, that and the other, but on the other hand, is it really in anyone's interest to kind of shove her out now with these rather difficult Brexit talks about to start?
The paradox is it's the precariousness of her position that keeps her there, because the whole pack of cards could simply collapse if there are too many rebellions. And I think people won't rebel. They'll look across and say, do you really want a Jeremy Corbyn government? Which is why they never needed to have made a deal with the DUP. And so people like Heidi Allen, Anna Soubry and others who might rebel on austerity questions probably won't quite when push comes to shove. But when it comes to the Brexit votes, these eight big Brexit bills, then all hell will break loose because, quite rightly, Brexit, they will see Brexit as far more important than the survival of one government. And both sides are absolutely adamant, the Remainers and the Leavers, and they will be willing to vote for what they believe in over that, even if it brings their government down. As a result, I don't think they can get any Brexit bills through at all. And then what happens?
But, Raf, there's just as much of a division on the Labour Party side as well, isn't there, on this?
Yes, the Labour position is terribly confused on this. And at the heart of the confusion, I think, there seems to be this enormous ambiguity about the Jeremy Corbyn, John McDonnell position on principle. Now, there's a sort of a structural, tactical ambiguity that's gone on, which is that Labour wanted to sort of scoop up the votes of anxious, sort of depressed and distressed Remainers in the general election by sort of signalling that they were the party to stop evil Tory hard Brexit. But they also needed to sort of staunch a flow of potential Leave voters in Labour constituencies to UKIP, and essentially accepting quite a hard Brexit in their manifesto gave them a very simple, clear position to say we accept the referendum, we'll do it. And also essentially gives you an answer to the question, what's Labour's policy on immigration, which had for a very long time been a massive problem. So Labour are tactically bound to this very ambiguous position. But then behind that is this separate question of whether or not Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell are actually ideologically quite hostile to membership of the European Union discreetly, because essentially the single market, the customs union, these are ultimately very liberal capitalist entities. They're governed by transnational competition law. There are prohibitions on the amount of, you know, of state subsidy that you can give to certain industries. I think that sort of a left Brexit argument overstates all that. But nonetheless, it simply isn't clear whether the problem that Labour has in sort of coming out very firmly and saying, look, some of this hard Brexit stuff is bonkers, we need to be looking at it at a completely different point of view, is a tactical thing because they essentially don't think the timing is right, or actually whether deep down, somewhere at the very top of the Labour Party, there's just a dislike of the European Union as just plain too capitalist.
But Raf, what you're underestimating is the extent to which the great Brexit split in the Tories may actually deliver Downing Street to Jeremy. And in the end, I think that will be far greater than he and John McDonnell having some natural distaste for Europe when it comes to it, with their whole, after all, virtually all of the MPs are passionately pro-European. If they see their opportunity and they see a split coming, you know, they will go with the effectively Remain or very soft Brexit side, because that's the way to Downing Street, as well as where most of their hearts are. And I don't think that Corbyn and McDonnell care all that much one way or the other about Europe.
But they do care a lot, and they do fret a lot about those voters who might have gone UKIP, who might have voted Leave in some of those kind of northern constituencies. And they are very conscious about wanting to stick with those people and wanting to have an answer to those people's concerns about, for example, immigration, aren't they? And they think getting out and getting out of the single market and so on gives them that answer.
But it may be that the anti-Brexit sentiment trumps the anti-immigration sentiment.
It would be wrong to see this also as a sort of distinction between a sort of a Corbyn left position and then a sort of PLP, what we used to call moderate position, because also there are a lot of what we, you know, sort of old Labour right, Labour centre, whatever you want to call it, people who were not at all massive fans of Jeremy Corbyn in the last Parliament, still aren't basically, but also very much take the view that you need to have quite a hard position on free movement of people, because that's the only way Labour can have any kind of argument on immigration that's going to cut through, and they recognise the need for that in their own constituencies. It's worth noting a story in the last 24 hours or so, which is Keir Starmer calling on the government to ease off on the red line on European Court of Justice jurisdiction. It's quite a sort of technical aspect of the negotiations, but it's so central to this point of whether or not realistically the UK can have a relationship with the single market that is institutionally much closer to the kind of Norwegian-Swiss variant than it is to a very hard Brexit. And if Labour's manoeuvring into a position where it says, steady on, ECJ is not all that bad, get over it, that is a very strong move towards a softer Brexit for Labour.
Yes, although I'm not sure there was unanimity on that.
No, I don't think there was.
To say the least. Sam, how worried should the Tories be about, we've talked about the splits over public sector pay. There's obviously a very wide spectrum of views about Brexit and the kind of Brexit we should have. We've heard some divisions on that start to be aired a bit. Could the Tories fall apart on this issue?
I think Europe has obviously for a very long time been very divisive within the Conservative Party. I think that before the election, when Theresa May gave her speech to Lancaster House and set out her top-level negotiating lines, it did seem to provide a fairly stable platform that the party could get behind. There was enough sort of internationalist rhetoric within there about global Britain and about free trade that I think a lot of people within the party who had been passionate Remain supporters could actually unite behind it and stand on that manifesto at the election. But I think with the election result obviously being very disappointing, and with the loss of certain like urban metropolitan seats like Canterbury and so on, I think that Remain voting Conservatives have seen an opportunity to maybe soften some of the aspects of Brexit that the Prime Minister was proposing. So the Chancellor has talked, I think, a lot more stridently now about some kind of transition arrangement, particularly on the customs union. And I think it'll be, I don't think it'll be a wholesale change. I still don't think that the single market membership is likely, or that there's a large chunk of Conservative MPs that would vote for that. But I think there are definitely aspects of the negotiating position, perhaps even on the ECJ issue.
Is there a champion for those Tories who are worried, who want a softer Brexit, who want a perhaps a more liberal stance? Or do they not need one because they think Theresa May can be kind of pushed around? I mean, it appears to have been her personal interest in the ECJ that has sort of driven that line, doesn't it? Can those soft Brexiters just move her on some of those things now? Or will there be people saying we need another leader to make this change?
I think within the cabinet, obviously, people like Philip Hammond seem quite big champions of that view. Obviously, he's limited to what he can say in public. I think outside of the cabinet, people like Ruth Davison have been very powerful in calling for a kind of review of the Conservative approach to Brexit after the election result. And I think the fact that she's got these new 12 MPs who, as if reports are to believe, are going to operate sort of semi-autonomously and with direct oversight by her from Edinburgh, then I think that could become quite a powerful factor within the Conservative Party. And then, of course, there are the usual suspects on the backbench, people like Dominic Grieve and Azubian, Nicky Morgan and so on. But I suspect the Ruth Davison element is the really new element in this parliament.
It's a sign. I'll just say it's a sign of new politics that we talk about Dominic Grieve as a usual suspect on the back benches. I mean, didn't that used to be Jacob Rees-Mogg? I mean, it's just in terms of the sort of symmetry of how the Remainers in the Conservative Party have now become this sort of liberal awkward squad. It's just in terms of the geometry of the Conservative Party, I find that kind of fascinating.
And sorry, Ruth Heather. Davidson is always the one who's mentioned, isn't she? When you talk to sort of the liberal Conservative MPs about, you know, who's your sort of champion, they get a wistful air and they say,
really do,
Ruth Davidson, but she's in the wrong place. Could that ever happen? Could she ever be parachuted down to Westminster? Or would that just not work? Is it just a different
very
market?
What's interesting is, I understand that, it's for sure, but I'm fairly confident that when the snap election was called, Ruth Davidson considered taking a Westminster seat. I mean, she had to quite quickly try and get selected if she wanted to do it, and thought, no, it's too soon and now's not the time. I bet she maybe regrets that decision now. I mean, because if she was in Parliament right now, there would be a very strong movement to get her right into the cabinet, possibly to the very top, quite quickly, because she does seem to have a capability in politics, which is separate from her sort of slightly liberal Remain-y sort of policy views, to just sort of. She has that kind of free-range political quality. She speaks human and expresses herself with a kind of effortlessly 21st century authenticity that is very noticeably lacking on the front bench of the Conservative Party at the moment. And again, going back to what we were saying earlier, you look at the one of the things that happened overnight on the election was the sudden aging of the Conservative Party culturally. It suddenly has that air of a slightly haggard, tired, derelict administration that's been around for a bit too long. And one of the reasons there isn't a great move to replace Theresa May is the feeling by a lot of people that if you were to replace her, you would need someone who could represent that kind of cultural, social renewal. And I think Ruth offers them that, and not many other people do.
It's just about plausible to imagine her being on the stage at Glastonbury, isn't it? It's quite hard to think of any of the Tory front bench ever making it to the pyramid stage, it seems.
I don't know. Dominic Grieve would be stuck in it.
You might be right. So with the Brexit clock ticking, one of the key players enforcing potential concessions is likely to be Labour's leader in the Lords, Angela Smith. So I asked her earlier this week how she's going to approach the coming blizzard of Brexit legislation.
It's an interesting time. I think some commentators have been a little bit too eager to say what's going to happen in the Lords. I think what is going to be very, very interesting is what happens in the House of Commons, as we've seen already, where the government is capitulating and changing policies because they know they can't get them through the House of Commons. But also, I think our role is going to be significant in the weeks and months to come. Not unreasonably so, or irrationally so, or improperly so, but it will continue to do the work that we do in scrutinising and challenging the government.
And a lot of that legislative programme, so the Queen's speech, a lot of the controversial things from the Tory manifesto were stripped out, but there are 8 Brexit-related bills, aren't there? That there's going to be a big role for the Lords there, presumably.
Well, the Lords and the Commons, and I still think what is interesting, and there's a lot of been talked about the Salisbury-Addison Convention, which is the convention back from the majority Labour government in 1945, when there was only a handful of Labour peers, but a very strong, radical, pragmatic programme from the Labour Party, which clearly had been completely wrong for the Lords to have tried to overturn that or deny that. But we're not in that kind of territory now. We've got a very weak Prime Minister, and I think there's more of a scenario whereby the House of Commons will assert itself against the executive. Now, Theresa May will not get everything her own way in the House of Commons. And when that legislation comes to us, of course, we recognise the primacy of the Commons and we want to examine the legislation. But what the government won't be able to do, I think, is say, well, this was the government's position, the House of Commons changed it, you must follow the government. We will do our job in the right way of proper scrutiny. Particularly those areas where the House of Commons sometimes doesn't even look at a whole bill, only part of it.
And I know one of the issues that you've raised in the Lords that you're particularly concerned about is the rights of British citizens that we have at the moment in virtue of our membership of the EU, isn't it? So we've talked a lot about British citizens who are already living in other EU countries and what might happen to them in future, and EU citizens already living here. But it's also the future rights of us and our kids and so on to be able to travel and to be able to retire abroad and those issues too, isn't it?
I raised this last week. You know, we have generations now who have got used to the idea we travel freely throughout Europe. I don't think about if I go on holiday, I have friends and family who have worked in Europe, and we take that for granted. And you're absolutely right. People have talked about the rights of EU citizens living here in the UK. Can they stay? Can they continue to work? We've talked about the rights of our citizens living in the EU. But what about UK citizens living in the UK who are going to lose the rights? And I don't think they're really aware of the extent and the impact that's going to have. Now, that will be part of the negotiations for the government, but at the moment there's a lack of awareness about it, and I think many young people have taken it for granted that companies they will work for in the future, they'll travel and work in different headquarters, different parts of that company, and that may not be able to happen if we don't get a sensible settlement from the government, and there's no indication yet the government is treating this seriously.
One more thing. How does Labour win the next election whenever it comes? Is it one more heave?
I think it's a little bit more than one more heave. You know, you have to look quite carefully at what happened in the election. And we did extremely well in a number of areas with the challenges in a lot of seats now. There's lots of seats where there's a very small Tory majority. But there are some areas we didn't do as well as we'd have liked to. My old seat, for example, the UKIP vote disappeared, but more went to the Tories than to us. So there's still a challenge for us in a number of areas. And, you know, we're meeting that challenge. I think we're up for that challenge. It's interesting, coming back and doing so much better than we expected. People are very excited. Lots of my friends and colleagues who, quite frankly, when they left here, when the election was called, thought they wouldn't be back, are now back with massively increased majorities. But we want to increase that.
That was Angela Smith. And aside from Brexit, Raph, Labour have come back from that general election campaign kind of reinvigorated and quite united, haven't they? Ready to talk about the domestic agenda and areas where they agree rather more.
Yes and no. Yes, there is a strong feeling among people who were not very kind of friendly towards Jeremy Corbyn's leadership before the election. Oh, there were sort of two components to this. First of all, yeah, they underestimated him and he did much better than they thought he would. So they are recalibrating their judgment of his political capabilities at one level. And second of all, so that there is a very strong realization that the mood in the party now is that he was treated very badly. He outperformed expectations and his critics should therefore just shut up for a bit. And so they are, in deference to their own members and constituency parties, shutting up for a bit. But, very important, but some of the underlying qualms they had about Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, which weren't about necessarily about electability, but actual points of principle, such as his attitude and his opinions on foreign policy and security, and quite how hostile he might be to all forms of capitalism, as opposed to just the particularly sort of Tory neoliberal brand that is easily attacked by everyone in the Labour Party. Those sort of basic intellectual and principled qualms haven't actually gone away, and I think there are MPs in the Labour Party who are very quietly experiencing quite a lot of agony about that and how they express that now.
And Polly, there's also a question about how the leadership uses its newfound kind of security and the fact that, you know, they did far better than expected during the election, isn't there? So we've already heard Ian Lavery, for example, who's a very close ally of Jeremy's, who's been given a new title as party chairman, suggesting the party has sometimes been too broad a church.
I mean, Ian Lavery suggesting that there are going to be mass deselections and we're too broad a church. I mean, under Blair, they were a broad enough church to include Jeremy Corbyn, who rebelled 500 times. So I don't know what kind of narrow church he has in mind. And it isn't clear whether that view really holds. The other thing that people are observing about both McDonnell and Corbyn is that all of a sudden reality has hit them that they might be inside number 10 and number 11 quite soon. And they have serious things to think about. They need money, for instance. Anti-austerity needs treasury receipts, and whether that makes them pause in what might be an instinctive anti-business move if there's a sudden flight of banks, of businesses, of inward investment, which is already happening because of Brexit. They need to stem that because they need money. And I think McDonald's quite realistic about that. If you're in there and suddenly, you know, the treasury is empty, that's not a lot of fun for anti-austerians.
Can I make a just quick point about these elections as well? It's worth noting that Labour MPs who have been a bit, you know, wary, sceptical, unhappy with Jeremy, varying degrees, also are very tribally Labour and would above all want a Labour government as opposed to any other kind of government. But if there is a strong move to deselection, then that leaves them with little choice but to think about the split. So just from a tactical point of view, if you're a big supporter of Jeremy Corbyn, the absolute last thing you want to do is basically force a bunch of Labour MPs to consider actually joining some other centrist party or breaking away, because it just gets you further away from a majority. So on its own terms, it's a rubbish strategy.
Well, it's a rubbish strategy, but on the other hand, some of them are crazy enough. You know, there are some people in there mad enough to think, good, we'll have a purer Labour Party, get rid of this scum, which is a terrifying thought, because it's, you know, just as they're about to succeed, it's a sure route to failure.
And then they would say a more democratic Labour Party, wouldn't they? They would say Jeremy's been involved for many years in the campaign for Labour Party democracy. Once he's got 550,000 members, extraordinary mass movement now, he wants to give those people more of a voice in the way the party is run and not have these sort of stitch-ups where people get seats, you know, because they're mates with this person or they're an organiser in a particular area. And
he's had a lot of stitch-ups of his own people. We can think of a long list of people that he's flown into all sorts of
seats. I think all leaders do that, don't they? Sam, to what extent is there concern on the Conservative benches, do you think, about an early election? Labour's already saying it's sort of putting itself in campaign mode and they're planning lots of rallies in marginal Tory seats and so on. Is that why Theresa May will end up hanging around longer than she might otherwise? Because nobody wants another campaign.
I think that's right. Yeah, I think that there is a huge concern about an early election. The polls are now definitively in Labour's favour, and that has been the trend over the past couple of months. And I think people fear that it would be quite a bad defeat if there was another general election. And I think that as much as there are disagreements about things like public sector pay cap or about Brexit, the uniting fear which is holding the Conservative Party together is of a Corbyn premiership. And I think that for that reason, Conservatives will be fairly well behaved over the next couple of years. It's not to say that they won't push the government on certain issues, but I think that they have a huge incentive to avoid another general election, because I think it would be very challenging. And Jeremy Corbyn obviously has a lot of momentum at the moment.
With a big M and a small M, yeah.
And a good thing too, may it last another 2 years. The Tory party created the Brexit catastrophe. Let them clear it up.
I think, yeah, just to pick up on that as well, I think the clock has already ticked on the Article 50 period by 3 or 4 months. And I think a lot of Conservatives are anxious as well of not having sufficient time to negotiate the Brexit deal. And if there isn't an agreement after the end of 2 years, obviously that would reflect very badly on the Conservative Party, and it would mean a lot of them wouldn't get the kind of Brexit vision that they'd hoped for and campaigned for. So I think they want to make sure that they get that right. And I think that's another reason to avoid an election.
From a snap election and, you know, Jeremy Corbyn being allegedly terrified of one, to the Tories being very nervous about the idea of going to the polls. How times change in such a short amount of time. Well, as we head towards the summer, you can continue to follow all our political reporting and analysis on theguardian.com. Now, the mass collection and usage of personal data is no longer news. But as the companies using it get ever more powerful and sophisticated, public understanding and awareness is not necessarily keeping pace. And we should worry about this, according to a new book, Weapons of Math Destruction, by Cathy O'Neill. She says that while algorithms are increasingly being used to sort job applications, monitor performance at work and manage credit availability, they're also reinforcing old prejudices and widening inequality. On a brief stop in the UK, I met her this week in Parliament.
It starts with finance, actually. I actually think of financial algorithms, quant stuff in finance, as the birthplace of data science and big data.
And you've been on that journey yourself, right? You worked in the financial sector. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I actually worked at a hedge fund during the crisis. I wasn't building the most pernicious algorithms, like the ones that scored mortgage-backed securities, like the AAA rated.
Which made people feel they were safe, right? They gave people an illusion of safety.
Exactly. Yeah. And they were just mathematical lies. But that is where I sort of became disillusioned with public-facing algorithms. Mm. I mean, to be clear, I think most of the algorithms going on in finance, there is a pretty straightforward incentive to make them accurate, because you don't make profit if they're not accurate, which isn't to say they're perfect. I'm not saying they're perfect. When the market models fail, everyone notices because everyone's looking at the market. But when algorithms that predict individual behavior fail, very few people notice. Maybe nobody. Maybe not even the person who was being targeted, because they often don't even know that they're being targeted. So it's very secret.
There are lots of good examples of this in the book, but give us a good example of how that can work, how someone going through their ordinary life can be judged and measured according to these models, maybe without even knowing it.
Well, I think an important example would be how people, when they're trying to apply for a job, often have to take personality tests online, and they fail and they don't know about it. And they just never get called for an interview. Actually, 70% of job applicants in the States, usually for minimum wage work, have to take personality tests. But at least in that case, they probably know that it's a test, right? Other people in white-collar jobs in the States, and increasingly probably in the UK, I know personality tests are very prevalent in the UK, but probably this other thing, which is basically what I call resume sorting algorithms. It's gone way beyond keyword searches, which HR departments have been using for a long time. But beyond that, algorithms applied to the actual, your resume, your CV, will decide whether you're a good fit for a job.
So this is, instead of a person sitting with a pile of CVs and reading them, this is a machine sorting through them, a computer sorting through them. You know, it seems like a, you know, rather efficient thing to do, but how do they go about it?
Well, it is an efficient thing to do, and I would argue probably a necessary thing to do in the world of the internet, where it used to be true that to get a job you had to go to a place and apply, but now everything is done online. So for a given job, they might have 10 times more applications. So it's a reasonable enough response to that flood of applications, but the problem is that it's not necessarily fair. And there's plenty of reason to imagine, especially if it's trained on historical data, that it's picked up historical practices that are unfair. So in other words, if we think that we had sexist hiring practices in the past, or if we think that women in companies weren't promoted fairly or the culture wasn't wasn't pleasant to them, so they left early. All those things would be picked up by the data as true signals, because of course algorithms don't know the question. They never know the question why. They never understand why something's happened. Although
the model is built based on who's succeeded in the system as it has been, as it is, and then that there's a sort of feedback loop that then.
That's a good way of saying it. I mean, basically what an algorithm does is it picks up patterns in the past. So it'll pick up patterns. Oh, women weren't hired. Oh, women didn't stay long. Oh, women weren't promoted. And they'll think there was a good reason. I mean, it won't think anything. Actually, it'll just pick up the pattern and it'll repeat that pattern. That's what algorithms do. So they sort of automate the status quo, as I say.
Yeah. And those great candidates who get chucked in the bin, nobody ever goes to find out what happened to them and feed that back into the model to say, oh, actually, maybe we missed a great candidate there. It's the model's kind of operating.
That's exactly right. What you're talking about is the false negatives. The false negatives where we should have hired that person, but we didn't and we'll never know, they will never be addressed.
So we're sitting here in Parliament. Politicians don't spend a great deal of time talking or thinking about big data, about its role in our lives. What should politicians be trying to do to sort of understand better? And are there ways that the legal system could work better, or the political system could work better to lift the lid on these models and to show people how they work and when they're pernicious?
I think it's a really important question, but I want to reframe the question. Mm-hmm. I want you to think about how much time and how much effort and how much marketing dollars come from Silicon Valley and other tech people trying to make the case that what they do is apolitical. Trying to make the case that what they're doing is pure innovation and has nothing to do with politics and has no opinion embedded in it. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying to market to politicians as well as to the rest of the world that what we're doing is just plain helpful.
It has this information is out there and we might as well make use of it.
And we're focused on efficiency, we're focused on cost saving, and that, you know, you should be asking us how to help you govern better. That is always the message coming from Silicon Valley. So one of the reasons that I haven't gotten a lot of feedback from Silicon Valley from my book, I think, is because they just simply want this conversation to go away. They don't like talking about the embedded politics of algorithms. So to answer your question, I have been trying to talk to policy people about this stuff, and many of them are very interested. But the truth is, at least in the States under the Trump administration, there's not a lot of bandwidth for really making a big deal out of this. Even the regulators who are aware of illegal algorithms, because there's plenty of algorithms that are embedding illegal practices within them, probably don't have the technological capacity to address it at this moment. So I'm kind of pessimistic about the next few years about dealing with this in a policy level way, but I do think in the next 20 years, so I'm looking at the 20-year horizon, I don't think it is possible for us not to address this because...
No, presumably we're talking about citizens starting to understand better, first of all, right? Yeah. What judgments are being made about them and how they're being made, and it's partly about sort of public understanding of this.
Well, that's why I wrote the book, for sure. I wanted the public to be made aware. And more importantly, I want the public to stop being intimidated by algorithms.
Because it's maths.
Right, because math is intimidating and almost... And I would say as a mathematician and as a person who loves math, that it is an abuse of the trust of mathematics, the way this stuff is being marketed as like objective and true and by the way, so authoritative and intimidating that you don't get to question it, right? So it's a very important goal of mine to get people to start questioning these algorithms, because after all, they're just decision-making processes that have been formalized in code. But any decision-making process that affects a given person's life fundamentally should be questioned, should be interrogated. So I'm trying to get people to interrogate those algorithms. It's a lot of power that people don't understand. I don't think policymakers really understand the power that is represented by that data. And data is the sort of raw ingredient to algorithms, and algorithms are powerful and influential. And there's no, I don't see there's any stopping this tide.
That was Cathy O'Neill, and her book, Weapons of Math Destruction, is published by Penguin and in shops now. Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Sam Hall, Polly Toynbee, Raphael Baer, Angela Smith and Cathy O'Neill. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.